VOA News.
Continues condemning Russia for its alleged atrocities against civilians in the areas around the capital of Kyiv.
They said that this burning of the bodies after shooting appeared to be an attempt to cover up what could be war crimes.
Plus, the U.S., EU, and G7 announced new sanctions against Russia, with Washington adding sanctions against Russian President Vladimir Putin's adult children.
So this is definitely, in terms of a psychological effect, this is getting personal, right? I mean, there's just no way around this. This is continuing to target the people that are the inner circle of Vladimir Putin.
And later in the program, the challenges doctors face working in wartime. Today is Wednesday, April 6th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. British military intelligence says heavy fighting and Russian airstrikes continue in the encircled Ukrainian city of Mariupol, as Ukrainian officials say Russian forces also struck overnight a fuel depot and a factory in Ukraine's Dnipropetrovsk region. The governor of Russia's Kursk region on the border with Ukraine said that Russian border guards were also fired at with mortars on Tuesday. The Ukrainian military has not yet commented on the allegation. The UN General Assembly is scheduled to vote on Thursday on a U.S. push to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council over allegations of Moscow's military killing of civilians in areas around Kyiv. The spokesperson of Russia's foreign ministry said Wednesday that images of dead bodies were staged and designed to justify more sanctions. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pushed Wednesday for more resolute action against Russia as the United States and European Union announced further punitive measures and NATO foreign ministers gathered in Brussels to discuss additional responses to the Russian invasion. Speaking with Turkish broadcaster Habertürk, Zelensky says Russia's military, political leadership, and everyone involved in the planning of this war, who gave the orders, who followed the orders, were all war criminals. He added that he thinks it is impossible to prosecute only one person for the crimes. He added, the international community must know, and the Russian Federation must know, that there are mass crimes and there could be no justification. Everyone should bear the responsibility. VOA's Heather Murdoch is back in the Kyiv area after traveling to areas outside the capital where the bodies of civilians were found. I spoke with her earlier, and please be aware, some of what you may hear may be graphic for some.
Yesterday, we were in Bucha, which is a town the Ukrainian government and all interested parties around the world call for an investigation into war crimes. What happened in Bucha was hundreds of civilians were killed, and among them, many of their bodies were found strewn on the ground, some with gunshot wounds or tied behind their back. We saw the government take some bodies that had been, as they said, shot and then later burnt and wrap them in plastic bags to go to be tested for identification. And they said that this burning of the bodies after shooting appeared to be an attempt to cover up what could be war crimes. Today, we went to Borodyanka, which is another town in the area of the Kyiv region, which the Ukrainian military has recently retaken. And this town was one of the hardest hit. There were several apartment buildings, very large apartment buildings, that were completely destroyed from what soldiers said were massive attacks about a couple of weeks ago.
Heather, what are residents there telling you about the attacks and really life living under Russian occupation?
We've heard that many people are missing and presumed dead from these attacks, possibly as many as 200. And we met families on the street there who told us that their time under Russian occupation was for the most part terrifying. I mean, for example, one guy told us that he was met by some Russian soldiers who held a gun to his head and forced him to help them loot a liquor store. Another woman said that a lot of her neighbor's houses had been looted, but she was just saved by the fact that she remained with children in the neighborhood as 80% of the rest of the people had fled. So now they're trying to clean up, recover, find, and bury their dead. But a lot of people also told us they're afraid that the Russian troops will come back and attack again.
Heather, you mentioned the horrifying circumstances that these individuals relayed to you under Russian occupation. Now that Russian forces have left, how are they reacting to the circumstances there because of the underlying humanitarian concern with dwindling resources?
There are efforts on the ground to get humanitarian aid to people, basic things like food and oil and fuel, but there's so many needs. For example, the town we were just in today doesn't have, actually most of the towns in the region doesn't have internet. The water's not running. The electricity is not running. Their buildings are destroyed. Many of the people are not even in their homes. We saw people trying to recover a few things that they could from apartments that had made it through the blast, like televisions or even a kitchen sink, some glasses, because almost anything is useful when you've lost almost everything.
VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from just outside the capital of Kyiv in Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Wednesday that negotiations with Ukraine were continuing, despite allegations of Russian forces attacking civilians in the Kyiv suburb of Bucha. The International Committee of the Red Cross also said it had successfully facilitated a convoy of more than 500 people from Mariupol to Zaporizhia on Wednesday. The convoy led by the ICRC departed on Tuesday from Berdansk and reached Zaporizhia on Wednesday. The organization said thousands of more civilians were still trapped inside Mariupol and need safe passage out, as well as the need for humanitarian aid to enter. The United States, European Union, and G7 announced on Wednesday that they were implementing new sanctions against Russia. I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara about them.
So all these sanctions are an extension of the sanctions that have already been placed in recent weeks. This is part of the ratcheting up pressure against Vladimir Putin. And from the announcement that was just given by the White House, we know that it's a full blocking sanctions on Sberbank. This is Russia's largest financial institution and also the country's largest private bank, Alpha Bank. Now, both of these banks have been sanctioned before, but not to the extent of a full blocking sanctions, which just means absolutely no transactions at all allowed within the jurisdictions of the West, including the U.S., EU, and the G7 countries. And in addition to that, the U.S. also said that it will block Russia from making debt payments with money that are subject to U.S. jurisdictions. And so essentially, this will make Russia default on its financial obligations.
Patsy, in addition to these new sanctions on the banks as well as limits on debt repayment, there's also additional sanctions on the adult children of Russian President Vladimir Putin, as well as members of Sergei Lavrov's, the Russian foreign minister's family.
So this is definitely, in terms of a psychological effect, this is getting personal, right? I mean, there's just no way around this. This is continuing to target the people that that are the inner circle of Vladimir Putin. First, we have the oligarchs. You know, we went after their yachts. We went after their London apartments. And now we're just getting into the inner circle of Vladimir Putin. In terms of the financial impact of these sanctions, we don't know yet what impact it might have. Certainly, perhaps not much on the Russian economy, but psychologically, definitely this is something that is designed to hurt Vladimir Putin personally. However, I have to add that even though the sanctions have been increasing, there have also been questions about the effectiveness of the this Western economic campaign against Moscow. As we know, Europe continues to buy billions of dollars worth of Russian oil and gas. And although the Biden administration has banned imports of Russian energy to the U.S., we have held off sanctioning international Russian energy transactions because we also have concerns about the impact of higher global energy prices on our domestic inflation. So there's certainly a couple more things that are still in the back pocket of President Biden. President Volodymyr Zelensky has asked President Biden to adopt stronger measures that so far the White House has resisted, such as closing international vessels off to Russian ports. So there's certainly more to be done as long as the atrocities, including the ones that we saw in Bucha in recent days, continue to persist.
Patsy Wiedekuswara is VOA's White House Bureau Chief Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The European Union also was meeting on Wednesday regarding the Russian war in Ukraine. And for that update, I spoke with Lisa Bryant in Paris.
What the EU member states are doing, it is at the moment, and I believe it's on the ambassadorial level, they're discussing a fifth round of sanctions. And the EU's executive arm has already announced what it would suggest as the latest sanctions. And that would include things like targeting more Russian banks, four or so, for sort of what is called de-swifting. I mean, to cut them out of Western ties. Another one would be a ban on the shipping, Russian shipping to Europe, except for like really humanitarian needs. And if it was agreed for the first time, the EU would be barring some energy imports from Russia, that is particularly coal, which experts say is the least, let's say, punishing for the Europeans in terms of their energy inputs from Russia.
Right. And there's been lots of discussions about the impact of European countries still beholden to Russian energy and making payments to Russia. And I wanted to ask you about one of the statements made today by Hungarian leader Viktor Orban, who said that if Russia asked, they would pay their debt for energy in rubles. What can you tell us about how that was received within the bloc?
Other EU member states are saying, look, we're going to continue with the existing contracts, which is in dollars or euros. And this is one way of, you know, further hitting Russian leader Vladimir Putin and other Russian oligarchs, et cetera, because it means that they'll have fewer, you know, dollars and euros on hand to pay for other things like their debt. But this is also not the first time that Viktor Orban has sort of pushed back against stronger EU measures. He's also talked about, you know, being against, and he's not the only one, but for different reasons, against a ban on Russian energy imports.
Lisa Bryant in Paris, France. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced a new indictment on Wednesday against a Russian oligarch.
The first action we are announcing today is the unsealing of an indictment charging Russian oligarch Konstantin Malyfev with sanctions violations. As the indictment charges, the Treasury Department previously identified Malyfev as one of the main sources of financing for Russians promoting separatism in Crimea and for providing material support for the so-called Donetsk People's Republic. After being sanctioned by the United States, Malyfev attempted to evade the sanctions by using co-conspirators to surreptitiously acquire and run media outlets across Europe. We are also announcing the seizure of millions of dollars from an account at a U.S. financial institution, which the indictment alleges constitutes proceeds traceable to Malyfev's sanctions violations.
Garland also disclosed efforts to disrupt a global botnet factory controlled by Russia's military intelligence, or the GRU.
The Russian government has recently used similar infrastructure to attack Ukrainian targets. Fortunately, we were able to disrupt this botnet before it could be used. Thanks to our close work with international partners, we were able to detect the infection of thousands of network hardware devices. We were then able to disable the GRU's control over those devices before the botnet could be weaponized.
He added that the United States is actively assisting those investigating the atrocities that were uncovered in Ukraine and is working to hold responsible parties accountable. NATO foreign ministers began their two-day meeting in Brussels on Wednesday amid growing pressure on the alliance to provide greater military support for Ukraine following the revelations of the alleged civilian massacres by Russian forces. Earlier, I spoke with VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London.
It's about the level of weaponry that NATO can supply to Ukrainian forces. We've seen them supply plenty of anti-tank weapons, some anti-aircraft and low-altitude weapons, which have proved effective on the battlefield and helped the Ukrainian forces drive back Russian troops north of Kiev and on some other key battlegrounds too. But Ukraine, it's accepted by NATO, isn't going to be able to defeat the Russian forces if it doesn't have more in the way of tanks, if it doesn't have more in the way of higher altitude anti-aircraft weapons, even anti-ship missiles that can target some of those Russian naval vessels that have been shelling the city of Odessa and other locations along the Black Sea coast. So this is the discussion that's going on over the next 2 days in NATO about what can be supplied to Ukraine and how effective it might be.
Henry, speaking at least about tanks, it appears that at least one country has already done that.
The Czech Republic has really set out early with its supply of Soviet-era tanks and infantry vehicles to Ukraine. Those are supplies that the Ukrainians will be able to use straight away because they are trained on them. They are the same Soviet-era weapons that they know how to use. There are other stocks of these Soviet-era weapons in other countries in Europe as well. And the discussion will be whether those can be released and sent to Ukraine, first of all. But those stocks are limited. They are running out. And so can the West, can NATO supply its own more modern Western-designed and built weaponry to Ukraine that it is able to use against Russian forces, more advanced anti-aircraft systems, anti-missile protection systems? Will there be the capacity to provide the training to Ukrainian forces to be able to use those? And crucially, will the supply of these heavier weapons and more effective weapons actually be seen by Russia as an escalation of the war that would be in danger of provoking action against NATO forces themselves? You know, would Russia see it that way? That's a difficult calculation for NATO leaders to make. But as those shocking images of the alleged atrocities of mass killings, rape, torture emerge, how long can NATO say that it will not provide any heavier weaponry to Ukraine? That's the debate that's going on in Brussels over the next 2 days.
Henry Ridgewell, reporting from London. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Moldova is watching the war in neighboring Ukraine with special concern as Russia threatens to take control of a significant portion of the former Soviet Republic. Like Ukraine, Moldova is not a member of NATO or the European Union. And like Ukraine, it has a very large Russian-speaking population. John Speer narrates this story.
The children of this school in southern Moldova rush to eat during their lunch hour like in any school in the world. But at these tables, we can hear many languages: Romanian, Russian, Gagaus, Bulgarian, a reflection of the cultural richness of this small country. Although in this part of Moldova, Russian is the language most widely spoken, the language at this school is Romanian, the official language of Moldova, which has gained ground in this country more than 30 years after independence.
In the Gagauzian Autonomous Region, we have a law by which three languages are official. The state language, Gagauzian, and Russian, they exist in symbiosis. No one bothers anyone for using one of these languages in shops, events, or jobs.
But the linguistic and cultural richness has another side. Some academics say the lack of a unique Moldovan identity has put the country at risk of falling under the influence of Moscow.
In 30 years, Moldova has not managed to build a unified national identity. There is a political identity. We are citizens of Moldova, but ethnic identification comes first. You are Romanian or Moldovan, Gagauz or Bulgarian, Russian or Ukrainian.
The war in Ukraine further highlights a battle that is going on over media in the linguistically divided Moldovan society over propaganda. Moldovan TV channels broadcast in several languages, usually Russian, Romanian, and Gagauz. For Tatiana, a Moldovan television journalist, it's very important that the current Moldovan multilingual system continues to include Russian, so that information reaches this community not only from the Kremlin's propaganda channels.
Bilingual programming is necessary so that there is no division in society. 30% of our population does not speak the language of the state. They are Gagauzians, Ukrainians, Bulgarians, Russians. It is a matter of respect for this community, and they must not remain uninformed.
Moldova, a former Soviet republic, last year celebrated 30 years of independence. It's paying close attention as the Russian military threatens to take control of a significant portion of Ukraine, which also was once part of the Soviet Union. For Ricardo Marchina in Chisinau, Moldova, John Speer, VOA News.
And since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, civilians have been wounded or killed during attacks. Despite the constant danger, Ukrainian doctors are fighting to prevent more deaths. Maria Prus talked to some about working in wartime.
Despite heavy shelling and with guns in their hands, Ukrainian doctors are saving lives. Doctors say the main children's hospital in Ukraine, Okhmadid, has been shelled a number of times.
Between 5 and 6 o'clock, we heard explosions, about 3 explosions not far from the hospital, so all staff and patients could hear them. Windows shattered, and so did the doors. Our neurology office was destroyed. Right now, we can't work there because the ceiling collapsed. But we keep helping people, we keep consulting, we still admit people to hospital, just in other buildings, in other parts of the hospital.
Doctors are pressing on in Mariupol, Sumy, Chernihiv, Kharkiv, and many other cities.
We're holding tight and try to do our job as best we can. When we are in ORs operating and we hear explosions, we try to keep calm and pray. We are working fast and without panic, trying not to think of what's happening outside the operating room. It's amazing to feel the unity and connection we all share.
Since the start of Russia's invasion, the World Health Organization has counted at least 64 attacks on medical institutions in Ukraine. In Mariupol, Russian forces captured an intensive care hospital and took hostages, according to the Media Initiative for Human Rights.
Every single person who works at the hospital knows what they are doing because the shelling has taken place in many cities already, massive shelling. And everyone knows what working at a hospital entails. They know it can easily become a target.
Most medical professionals work grueling hours for days on end. Others live in hospitals.
When the war started, on the first day, I couldn't get to my workplace. And when I did manage to leave the house, it took me 3 hours to get there. So I decided to just leave at the hospital. We have a shelter here and people who can always help.
Thanks to volunteers and private organizations, members of the hospital staff, at least for now, are getting what they need.
Supplies of food and medications into hospitals have been working very well. Both companies and volunteers are making food for hospitals or delivering groceries so that we can make food here.
Much of the humanitarian aid is coming to hospitals from abroad, including from the US and Europe.
These are not just syringes and gloves. There are lots of medications, including, for example, a wound vac. My clinic just sent some to Ukraine. It helps wounds close up faster. I think if it goes on for a few more months, and it seems likely that it will, Ukraine will have a lot of modern medical assistance in all hospitals around the country.
Like many Ukrainians, doctors are closer and resolute.
To be honest, I never thought my colleagues and I could unite like this. We are like a large family, but when you are working side by side for days in a row, you realize these are your people, they will help. We will definitely win. We are waiting for victory every day, and we will do everything in our power to bring the victory closer.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warns that Ukraine's health facilities are stretched beyond capacity as new patients keep coming and humanitarian needs grow. Maria Prus, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world 24 hours a day. You can do so at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow at VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, Bob Bozet, D.C.